On In Good Faith, we believe that all faith traditions have something to teach us about how God is working in the world and in our lives. So join us as we listen and learn. Today on In Good Faith, our guest is author and teacher Philip Goldberg, and I'm really intrigued by how he talks about learning religion by experience. So more about that in a moment. In studio with me is senior producer Heather Bigley.
Hello.
And also producer Ashton Rowan.
Hi, Steve.
Ashton, you mentioned something that really caught your ear in this interview with Philip.
Yeah, I think Phil is a wonderful example of openness and being able to change your mind and being open to experience and learning from yourself, learning from others, and being able to really just learn in general.
I like you called him Phil.
Well, he was calling himself that.
No, that's awesome. I, too, like that Phil has this journey that we go with of someone who was raised in a home where religion is for stupid people. Religion is for the weak. It's for people who don't really want to face reality. It's for people who, right, et cetera, et cetera. I think we've heard those things before. And here's a person who eventually connects to something spiritual that teaches him, right, oh, there's something greater in this universe.
And it really becomes his life. Philip Goldberg is an author, a co-author of numerous books. He's a public speaker, a workshop leader, spiritual counselor, meditation teacher, and ordained interfaith minister. He hosts the Spirit Matters podcast, and most recently in 2020, wrote Spiritual Practice for Crazy Times. Yeah, this is a journey that I was really, really interested to hear about, where he ended up, especially given, as you hinted, he did not come from this super religious home.
I was raised in an anti-religious home, not only non-religious, but anti-religious. My parents were secular people of Jewish descent. In the post-World War II years, when they believed that religion was the opium of the people, like Marx did. And that's how I was raised, with atheist parents, very secular, but of high moral and ethical integrity. And so that's the attitude I had about religion well into college. And then things changed.
Any particular incident?
Yeah, you know, it was the late 1960s, and I was part of that generation that was discontent with things as they were. It was the time of Vietnam War, civil rights upheavals, and I was very politically active. And at the same time, it seemed like every day was a new existential crisis. We were searching for how to live a good life in the world, and we saw a lot of unhappy people living what seemed to be the American dream, and we said, that's not the answer. And in our searching, somehow the literature about Eastern philosophies, the Eastern spiritual traditions, what we think of as Hinduism, Buddhism, Taoism,
right,
they came to our attention through elders we respected, famous people, eventually the Beatles and others who turned to the East for spiritual sustenance. And that's when I discovered there were aspects of spirituality that were quite different from conventional religion. So I turned eastward, and that was transformative.
Did that fill sort of a gap, or was it just an expansion? Was it something you were looking for as you were growing up?
I was looking for how to be happy. What's it all about? Why are we here? What's the meaning of being here? How do I connect with the rest of the cosmos? Are there aspects to life that I'm not being taught? And then in that search, yes, a big gap in my inner life was filled, and a big gap in my awareness and my consciousness was beginning to be filled. And I couldn't get enough. Every little thing I read was another brick in the edifice of my transformation. And I wanted more, and I wanted more. I wanted to learn more and experience more. Because the crucial thing that I discovered, and millions like me have, is that the Eastern traditions didn't ask me to convert to anything. And they didn't ask me to believe in stories that I found hard to believe, that went against the grain of rationality, of scientific evidence, of known history, or any of that. They just basically said, this is what our great sages and seers have discovered, whether it was Buddha, yogis in the Indian tradition. We discovered certain things by turning within and investigating consciousness. But the key thing was, it was about experience. It was about, we have these methods. They're called yoga, they're called meditation, they're called mindfulness, they're called, you know, different things. They're universal. You can think of them as the equivalent of a technology. It's applied science. We've had certain insights, we develop these methods. If you do them, you're likely to find your life improves in certain ways that we can predict. And it circled back to the Western traditions, which I had soundly rejected, because I discovered in the more esoteric, what we think of as the mystical branches of Judaism and Christianity and Islam, there's direct parallels to the Eastern traditions. And when I discovered that, I became a kind of all-purpose, what I call pragmatic mystic. Mm-hmm. I was able to learn from all the different traditions. And I think that's a great blessing that we have in the modern world, that we have access to all this.
Is there an experience or two you might share that you could describe your own personal experience?
Yes, the critical turning point for me was I had experimented with things I was reading, Zen meditation, various yoga practices. And then when the Beatles took up transcendental meditation and put that on the map, and their guru, Maharishi Mahesh Yogi. And then when they went to India for an extended stay in a meditation ashram, that caught the world's attention. And at first, I was very cynical. I said, well, I'm not going to take this up just because John and Paul did. But I investigated it, and then I met people who had benefited from that particular practice. So I said, okay, I'll give it a try. And I did, and it really was transformative, this deep meditation that I committed to doing twice a day for a while as a essentially an experiment. And I suddenly found my life changing. I had more inner calm. I had a more clear mind. I started giving up bad habits like cigarettes and drugs and all kinds of things. And over the course of a year or two, I found my life was very different. So it had practical implications in my life and the many people around me. And then, as I chronicle in my book, In American Veda, that was a watershed period that extended beyond that particular form of meditation and that particular guru. And all the other teachers from the East gained greater currency, and people found their ways to the teachers they liked. And through those teachers, in many cases, returned to the tradition they grew up in and may have rejected because they were seeing it with new eyes. That never happened to me because, but I opened up to at least learning from and respecting the more mainstream traditions of my culture through the teachers of the East. It's a remarkable sort of phenomenon, but I'm not alone by any means.
You're listening to In Good Faith. I'm Stephen Cap Perry. We'll be back in a moment. I'm Stephen Cap Perry, host of the In Good Faith podcast, and I want to tell you about another in our family of BYU Radio podcasts. an award-winning show with an award-winning host. This is Julie Rose on Top of Mind. Do you get turned off by the news because of how angry and polarizing and even depressing it can be? Doesn't anybody know how to have a civil conversation or weigh two competing ideas without a knee-jerk reaction that if you don't think what I think, you're a bad person? Check out the podcast, Top of Mind. They take one tough topic and they dive deep. And the goal is learning how to stay open and curious, even when you're confronted with different perspectives that may challenge us. Learning how to stick with the discomfort until we feel like we've actually learned and gotten some understanding. We may change our minds, we may not, but every episode will leave you feeling hopeful and empowered to become a better advocate for what does matter to you. Top of Mind, listen to the podcast wherever you get your podcasts. This is In Good Faith, and I'm talking about mysticism as a spiritual pathway for many non-religious people with author and teacher Philip Goldberg. I'm curious if, the more you explain, the more I want to know about, which is probably a sign of a good teacher.
Thank you. Or a blabbermouth.
They could overlap. The Venn diagram could overlap.
Yes, they do, yeah.
I'm so curious. Religion can be held up as one of the great goods in our society. Everything from encouraging civil rights to filling in the gaps the government can't or doesn't, to also keeping people in their place. There's such a variety. Maybe that's the wrong phrase, yeah. But what gives you hope about spirituality in America or in the world at large today?
You alluded to the positive contributions of religion, which I think in certain circles are underappreciated because it's easy to see the harm that religions have done. I have friends who are Christian ministers who, when they think of the history of the Crusades and the Holocaust and everything else, it's a source of deep chagrin and shame. But at the same time that slavery, for example, was justified in the name of religion, the flip side of that is the leading abolitionists were doing it because of religion.
Out of the same books.
Out of the same books, but different interpretations. And people are very upset. People who I know and progressives and all that, it's very alarming, this rise of Christian nationalism, the influence of fundamentalism in the world of all kinds of religious extremism and fundamentalism and their encroachment on the public sphere. But every once in a while, you have to remind them that, yeah, but Martin Luther King and Gandhi were religious people too. And good is done. And yes, there's a lot of hypocrisy and there's thieves and miserable people in pulpits every Sunday and so forth. We know that. At the same time, what we don't necessarily appreciate is how much harm was avoided because somebody had a religious precept or a religious leader to guide and comfort that person before they did something horrible. It's a mixed thing, just as there are crooked lawyers, but if you need help, you turn to an honest lawyer. And so religion is mixed. But one of the things I find hopeful is what we've been talking about, the growing awareness of the contemplative or spiritual aspect of religion. One of the phenomena I described in American Veda, and it's now been 10 or 12 years since, it's even more pronounced. The introduction of meditative practices from Hindu and Buddhist traditions open the awareness of Christian and Jewish leaders who said, wait, don't we have stuff like that in our traditions? And so there's been a big rise in the popularity of contemplative Christianity, of Jewish mysticism, of Sufism as a branch of Islam. So the experiential aspect of what we call religion, and which many people don't want to call religion. That's why we have this phenomenon of more than a quarter of the population calling themselves spiritual but not religious. The experiential aspect of it, which leads to personal transformation in ways that just adopting a belief system can never do. That, to me, the growth of that gives me hope for a number of reasons. One, it makes people better people. But second, it washes away all the, or gradually perhaps, the potential for conflict between belief systems, because you discover this commonality of inner experience, and that there's a certain harmony, and I don't like using the word tolerance, but of mutual respect and enrichment. I can even learn from this person whose belief system is different from mine, because we share a commonality of experience of the divine. And maybe there's more to it than I realized.
I'm curious, maybe you might even help me rephrase this question in the best way to elicit a thoughtful answer, but the whole idea with whether it's biblical or whether it's the Vedas, it's the Bhagavad Gita, whether it's Quran, for some, it is incredibly important to see every word of those as literal, which I think was part of maybe why your parents were not fans.
Right.
What do you find good, or is there anything dangerous in going purely metaphorical in the understanding? Like, what is the lesson we learned from this tale, whether it happened exactly as expressed or not?
This business of taking sacred books literally, it's a dicey proposition. It's the religious equivalent of literalism in the law, you know, reading the Constitution literally. It's like you can't separate out context from historical and geographical context of these texts. They were written at a certain time. They weren't even written. They were, for the most part, usually oral transmissions that were later written. And then you realize, wait a minute, the Bible wasn't written in English. The Upanishads weren't written in English. Somebody, some human being, translated them. And then they were retranslated and retranslated. So what it's like, the telephone game, what gets lost? And then religious councils enter in and say, no, we don't want them to know that. Let's change it to this. And then history and people's accounts, eyewitness accounts and all that gets transmitted down through the generations. And then people start embellishing because, you know, if you're a good storyteller, you embellish, you leave something out, you add something so people will absorb it better. So how can we possibly take things literally with all this adulteration? So that's why I have trouble. And one of the things I can now do that I couldn't earlier on is I can go to a church on Christmas Eve or whatever, or any Sunday, I can go to a Passover Seder at my wife's family's house, and I read between the lines. I look for the spiritual message that may have been intended before everybody started getting literal and looking at the letter of things instead of the spiritual message. Just found meaning in the fact that so much a part of the world celebrates this moment when Christ enters Jerusalem. And there's different ways of interpreting that, and I found out some really fun stuff about it. But to me, it meant several things, one of which was entering the holy city of Jerusalem is analogous to us entering the holy place within ourselves. And that I can enjoy that metaphorically and see that message in it. That, to me, has value. But if it's only metaphorical, as you say, maybe you lose something. There is a certain history there. There are life lessons. The story that Jews celebrate at Passover has been used by many Christians as a metaphor for overcoming oppression and as a great example in history of overcoming the oppression. You find it in gospel music. So there are life lessons here, too, in some of the stories, and not just what we think of as spiritual, but spiritual as applied to life. But if you take everything literally, then you end up in conflict with people who interpret it differently. And then you end up with extremism and fundamentalism. And I think we've had quite enough of the damage that can be done through that kind of thing.
A spiritual awakening like you're describing could be thought of in a couple different ways. Two that come to mind are, one, just opening your consciousness to something that exists within that you might not have been aware of. Something that seems almost like another or maybe possibly linked approach would be suddenly having a connection with something you now call the divine or even God. What was that like for you?
I think they're both the same thing. At first, it was like turn within, transform from inside. I resisted God language because of my upbringing. But when it's called in the Eastern traditions pure consciousness as translated into English, or universal consciousness, or union as in the definition of yoga, becoming unified, the personal self and the cosmic self, which other people would be calling God or Allah or terms like the divine. One of the core teachings that I embraced from the Ich was that the discovery of the divine within me is the same as discovery of the divine outside of me, and there's really no separation. That's a later realization. The first is discover the divine within yourself. And for some people who are more devotionally oriented than I was then, the link is quite easy to make. The more I'm in touch with the divine within myself, the more I can appreciate the expression of the divine in the trees and in the other human beings and in everything around me. And that's a classic Eastern spiritual development moment.
Well, you've described it beautifully. I'm wondering, as later you said, you began seeing the more contemplative side, or mystical side, I think you said, of the Western traditions. Yeah. Were you surprised by the commonalities that you found?
Shocked at first, but then I discovered there were scholars and people who had been investigating those commonalities for quite a while. If you look at what people devoted to any path experience and how the contemplatives and the mystics of those traditions express what they experience inside, you see commonalities. And people have done rigorous research on this and turns out to be quite provable and demonstrable in people's lives. It's one of the reasons I later became an interfaith minister, so I could work with people of all traditions. And in my limited experience there and in gatherings of people who are practicing from different spiritual histories and traditions and belief systems, when you talk about what did you actually experience? What do you experience when you pray? What does it feel like? How would you describe it? You find people using the same expressions, expressing the same things. And that is where unity comes in, and I wish there were more of it.
I was speaking with Philip Goldberg, an author, a teacher, and the interfaith minister. But my favorite part of his journey is his journey into Eastern religion and then finding the contemplative aspect that was, through his own experience, showed him it was making a difference in his life. Then he finds out about contemplative Christianity and Islam and Judaism, and suddenly he has room in his head and his heart for all of it.
Yeah. One of my favorite things that he talked about was how adopting a belief system can never lead to a personal transformation like an experiential practice. This just reminds me of Jesus saying to us, experiment upon his word, right?
Yeah.
And in experimenting, in trying it out and giving it a chance in our lives, then we see what it can do for us. And then we see what we can do for others.
So Philip Goldberg, I felt like kind of went from mind to heart and then combined them both, really bringing in the head with the heart to accomplish good. Many thanks to Philip Goldberg for speaking with us. This episode was produced by Ashton Rowan and me, Stephen Cap Perry. Our production team also includes senior producer Heather Bigley, Leah King, Katarina Martinich, and Josh Orton. Our post-production sound designers are Mark Hansen, Brandon Lewis, Daniel Phillips, and Carly Wilson. In Good Faith is committed to the idea that we all benefit from hearing people of widely varying backgrounds share their personal experience with faith and belief. In fact, we think people with such experience deserve some of our best listening. If interfaith understanding is important to you, be sure you leave a positive comment or review, YouTube, Spotify, Apple, wherever you get your podcasts. Find us on Twitter at InGoodFaithPod, Instagram and Facebook, we're InGoodFaithPodcast, and on YouTube, youtube.com/@in-good-faith. In Good Faith is a production of BYU Radio. I'm Stephen Cap Perry. I hope you'll join me again soon, right here, In Good Faith.